Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripancic. On today's show, we'll hear a presentation from progressive economist Dean Baker, where he discusses background details on the recent economic situation. But now, we'll hear the first of two commentaries from the website Black Agenda Report.
For the first time since federal agencies have been keeping racial statistics on drug convictions, there has been a decline in the number of African Americans incarcerated on drug charges. White incarceration in state prisons on drug charges increased during that same period between 1999 and 2005, according to a new study conducted by the Sentencing Project based in Washington, D.C. The black decline in drug imprisonment was significant at a little over 21%, but the white increase was breathtaking, about twice as high as the black decline at 42.6%. So, why is drug incarceration moving in different directions for whites and blacks? Probably for very different reasons, since the two groups are treated so differently by law enforcement. But first, let's emphasize that the big picture still hasn't changed. Blacks continue to make up 44% of state prisoners doing time for drugs, while whites comprise only 27% of drug prison inmates, although whites are 75% of the U.S. population. Remember that study after study has shown that blacks and whites do drugs at about the same rate. It is the difference in law enforcement's treatment of drug use among blacks and whites that creates the huge disparities in arrests, charges, and eventual incarceration. With that understanding as a backdrop, it seems logical to conclude that a veritable drug binge occurred among whites from the late 90s to the middle of the current decade, an explosion of drug sale and use to which the criminal justice system was forced to respond in an uncharacteristically harsh manner. The methamphetamine epidemic among whites was so destructive, so in your face, it could not be swept under the rug. White arrests soared skyward, but an increase in white drug imprisonment does not automatically lead to a decline in black incarceration. It is generally acknowledged that the crack cocaine trade is less of a free-for-all than in decades past, which would account for some decline in black incarceration. Corporate media managed to find some so-called experts who claim that racial profiling is on the decline, but that's a bunch of nonsense unsupported by any evidence. What may have occurred is, after three solid decades of merciless, predatory policing of black communities, which seemed intended to sweep the streets of as many young blacks as the prisons could consume, the criminal justice system simply reached saturation point. They had arrested every young African-American male and increasing numbers of females that they could wrap their tentacles around, and had finally reached the point of dwindling returns. If such is the case, if black drug incarceration rates are on the decline because the system ran out of easily grabbable victims, this represents no victory or turnaround for black America. It means only that the police have whipped on us until they got tired. And now, with white drug incarceration so dramatically on the rise, now we finally hear murmurings about the need for prison reform. In a racism-saturated society, there are no statistical coincidences involving questions of crime and punishment. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com. Some of Barack Obama's chickens and other assorted farm animals are coming home to roost. 6 months into his term as United States Senator, Barack Obama introduced legislation to compensate black farmers for the cruel and blatant discrimination they'd suffered at the hands of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Obama had apparently been moved by the black farmers' claims that federal farm officials had methodically denied them federal monies routinely handed out to white farmers. According to the Washington-based Environmental Working Group, black farmers received only one-third to one-sixth of the federal benefits and subsidies collected by other farmers over more than a 10-year period. Black farmers, as a class, were becoming extinct, partly due to federal government practices. The black farmers sued, forcing the federal government to pay out nearly $1 billion to settle about 16,000 claims. But as many as 65,000 additional farmers had claims that could amount to as much as $4 billion. That's when Senator Obama joined legislation to champion their cause. Congress allocated $100 million with the apparent intention to release more funds later. But it didn't turn out that way, and the black farmers have come to believe that now President Obama is flipping the script on them. Last week, the black farmers and their supporters turned out in force on Capitol Hill, demanding that the Obama administration and the Congress do right by the 94,000 of their fellow tillers of the soil who ultimately filed for claims against the feds. Obama had indeed changed his tune upon becoming president. Now, his administration's position was that the initial $100 million was all the black farmers were going to get. It wasn't a down payment, but a cap, a ceiling. The black farmers felt betrayed. John Boyd, president of the National Black Farmers Association, said Obama's formula wouldn't even pay the lawyers' fees. Many of his members are facing imminent loss of their land. Obama and congressional Democrats urged the black farmers to have patience, but John Boyd replied, "It's too late for that." They didn't tell the banks, the auto companies, and the insurance companies to wait, said Boyd. He continued, right is right, and it doesn't matter who is in the White House. That's when Obama trotted out black Alabama Congressman Archer Davis to take the heat from the black farmers. Congressman Davis, one of the most corporate-friendly members of the Congressional Black Caucus and a protege of White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, claimed the $100 million was just a placeholder for monies that would be allocated in due time, that it was not a cap, despite what administration lawyers had said in a legal motion filed in February. The black farmers' patience may be short, but time is in even shorter supply. A little over a century ago, blacks made up 14% of all American farmers. Today, they are less than 1.5%. Congressman Davis tried to reassure the farmers. "I know the heart of the president," he said. But Obama's heart doesn't sign any checks. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature a presentation from progressive economist Dean Baker, where he discusses background details on the recent economic situation. Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Dean Baker spoke as a featured speaker at the 2009 conference of the Illinois Coalition for Justice, Peace, and the Environment, held in People's Church in Chicago on Friday, April 17, 2009.
I'm glad to be back. I'm from Chicago originally, so it's really great to come back to Chicago in the middle of the Depression. What I want to do is sort of quickly go through the basic story of how we got here. It won't be new to any of you, but it is, I think, worth trying to keep this in mind, because we have a lot of people who are trying to reconstruct the story, make it very different from what it is, and sort of deny their own guilt in the process. So I want to sort of quickly go through the story of where the economy is, how we got here, and how at least some people will try to get us out of what they're trying to do, basically give all our money to the banks, and then at least very briefly talk a bit about an alternative, which involves a stimulus program, round three, that will be needed to get the economy going again. Well, the basic story, and when I'm saying this, I realize this may be redundant, everyone knows this, but I just say this because sitting in Washington, I hear people say the opposite. The basic story was incredibly simple. The basic story was we had a huge housing bubble. By my calculations, the housing bubble was on the order of $8 trillion at its peak in 2006, and it was easy to see, any economist, economic analyst, and as easy as it was going to end very badly. $8 trillion, just to put that in numbers we could relate to, it comes to about $110,000 in equity, housing equity, bubble equity, for every homeowner in the country. That's a really big story. The bubble was driving the economy for the whole decade. The reason it was driving the economy, on the one hand, when you had house prices go through the roof, you had a huge boom in construction. Construction ordinarily is about 4% of the economy. It grew to be more than 6% of the economy at its peak in 2005. So we had a huge uptick in construction driven by inflated house prices. The other thing that the housing bubble did was it drove consumption, because you had all these people who thought they had all this wealth in their home, and they spent based on their wealth. And that's actually a very well-known economic relationship. It's called the wealth effect. And economists have done volumes of research on this, and usually they estimate the wealth effect on housing somewhere between 5 to 7 cents on the dollar. So in other words, if you have an extra $1,000 of housing wealth, well, we'd expect that you would spend, the average person would spend on the order of $50 to $70 more in consumption. Well, the reason why this was important, that was driving the economy. The savings rate fell actually below zero in the years 05, 06, 07, because everyone thought they had so much wealth in their home, they didn't feel they needed to save. In some cases, people borrowed directly against their wealth. They would take out home equity loans, refinance their mortgage, pull money out of their house, use it to take a vacation, buy a car, maybe they used it to put their kids through school. A lot of people were, of course, stretched. They needed just to pay the bills. The other part of the story was you have people who may otherwise have been saving for retirement. They didn't see any need to put money in a 401k because the house is basically saving for them. If your house went up in value $10,000 a year, you don't think you have to put money in a 401k. All right, well, that was what was driving the economy through this period. My point that I always make about this was it was really, really simple. There's been a great effort on the part of the media to say, oh, it was incredibly complex, it required tremendous insight, you know, it was just, you know, we couldn't figure this out. That's crap. It was really easy to see. And the reason why I say it was really easy to see, and the reason why it's important, is we have to know who's to blame. It was easy to see because we could go back for 100 years. We had data 1895 to 1995. House prices had just kept even with the overall rate of inflation. It's a very long period. It's a very big market. This isn't some tiny, obscure metal. We're not talking about gypsum or something that's a tiny market. This is a huge, huge market, far and away the largest single market in the country, housing. Look, for a century, house prices just keep even with the rate of inflation. Suddenly, in the mid-90s, house prices begin to hugely outstrip the rate of inflation, so that by their peak in 2006, they had risen by more than 70% when you adjust for inflation. So you have this huge break from a 100-year-long trend, interestingly coinciding with the growth of the stock bubble, begins in the mid-90s also. And there's no explanation for it in the fundamentals. That should have been very easy to see. In fact, it's almost impossible not to see if you're an economist with your eyes open. The other part of the story, and I debate a lot of people, you go, okay, give me the fundamentals, supply, demand. That's real simple, right? What was the demand story? Was there real good income growth? There was decent income growth in the late 90s, but it was no more rapid than what we had in the whole post-war period, the early post-war period. So we had 4 years of relatively good income growth, 96 to 2000, but it was no more rapid than what we had in this long period from the end of World War II until 73. So that wasn't much of a story. And then, of course, in this decade, income stopped growing. It actually fell. So there was really no income story. I heard it several people, including Alan Greenspan, say, well, it was because of population growth. And you know, you go, no, that one doesn't fit. The whole story was we had the baby boomers, you know, this huge cohort that we all first began forming our own families, buying homes in the 70s and 80s. Maybe that would have explained the run-up in house prices in those decades. It doesn't explain the run-up in house prices at the end of the 90s in this decade. That makes no sense. So you had no demand story. Was there a supply story? Well, there were different things thrown out. I know Greenspan once said, well, because of all these environmental restrictions, they can't build anything. Well, this wasn't exactly the heyday of environmentalism. Republicans took over Congress, took over a lot of state houses. This wasn't the heyday of environmentalism. That didn't make a lot of sense. But you don't even have to argue. You just look at the numbers. Are we building houses? And very simple answer, yes. 2002 and 2006, we're building houses at near record rates. So no supply constraints, no demand constraints. Houses driven by fundamentals. Okay, then a couple other factors. You know, you want to get a little technical. Look at vacancy rates. Well, vacancy rates were rising through this period. How do you have house prices rising because of the fundamentals, but you have a record rate of vacancies? That doesn't make any sense. Last part of the story, what's going on in the rental market? Because at the end of the day, there is one housing market. People aren't, by birth, homeowners. They make a choice. Are you going to be a homeowner or are you going to be a renter? And of course, property switches back and forth. If you're sitting there with a vacant rental unit and house prices are going through the roof, well, people turn them into condos. That was happening. Well, the story with rents was there was no story. Rents rose pretty much with the overall rate of inflation. So long and short of this was, it should have been very easy. There was no excuse for people like Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, Tim Geithner, Larry Summers. There was no excuse for them not to see this bubble. It was not complex. Credit default swaps, collateralized debt obligations, a lot of the alphabet soup of financial instruments that were created in this period. Some of those are complex. Some of the details certainly are very complex. But the basic story was incredibly simple. If they were awake, they should have seen it. There was no good excuse not to see it. Okay, well, where are we now? Well, we have a collapsed bubble. What does a collapsed bubble mean? People stopped building homes. We have an incredible oversupply of housing because of all the housing that got built over this period. And what that means is housing has shrank as a share of the economy. It was over 6%, as I said. It's now down to less than 3%. We lost an amount equal to 3% of GDP. That's about $450 billion a year in demand. Second big part of that story, consumption. We have people spending, you know, as I was just saying, with this big wealth effect. People saw this wealth in their home, so they were spending based on it. The wealth has now disappeared. We've lost about $6 trillion of the $8 trillion. I'm very confident we'll lose the other $2 trillion shortly, maybe more than that. People stopped spending, so we lost around $500 to $600 billion a year in annual consumption. Third part of the story, there was also a boom in non-residential real estate that trailed as the housing boom trailed off. There's this big boom in non-residential real estate. We had huge overbuilding in hotels and in office space, retail space. Some of you might have seen the second largest mall chain in the country, which is based here in Chicago, just declared bankruptcy yesterday. It's because they have all these empty malls. They lost a lot of money. So we've seen an end in a boom in non-residential construction. Long and short, if you add up the lost demand, we're looking at the order of $1.3 trillion a year to make this comparable. We've lost on the order of $2.6 trillion in demand over the two-year period, let's say 2009-2010. My reason for giving that number, $2.6 trillion, we all know about the stimulus package. We had a stimulus package on the order of $700 billion. That's helpful. It was a good thing Congress passed that. It's nowhere near enough to turn the economy around. We're in a very, very deep hole. So that's just a very, very basic story. And for the most part, I think it's a very simple story. Now, where are we going with all this? Well, unfortunately, I've told a lot of people my big hope for President Obama, or my big reason I'll say this, I preferred Obama in the primaries over Senator Clinton, or Secretary of State now Clinton. My big reason for preferring that was I didn't want to see Bill Clinton's economic team back in the White House. Probably didn't want to see Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State either. But in any case, that's what we have. And the reason for not wanting to see them is because it was a very Wall Street-oriented crew. And what we have right now is an effort to basically save the banks. The banks were speculating like crazy. They were making money hand over fist in this story. And by all rights, most of them should go out of business. I'm not saying that's a moral judgment, although that would be my moral judgment. But simply as an economic judgment, that's what's supposed to happen in a capitalist economy when you lose money and you can't pay your debts. But instead of letting Citibank and Bank of America and probably most of the others, Goldman Sachs, go under, we're bailing them out, and we're bailing them out supposedly with the rationale that we have to do that for the good of the economy. And I won't go through all the long and short of this, but I'll just make two big points on this, two main points on it. One is we are handing them money. There's all this, you know, trying to say that, no, we're just lending them to them, we're just, you know, we're not really giving them anything. We are handing them money. I'll just make a couple points on that. And secondly, we don't have to. In terms of handing them money, I'll just take the crudest example. You all know about the bailout of AIG, and AIG ended up costing the government, well, maybe ended up costing us much more than that, but to date it's cost us roughly $160 billion. That's not money we're going to get back. There's not a plausible story to tell we're going to get that back. I mean, maybe we'll get $10 billion back. We're not going to get the vast majority of that back. What did AIG do with this $160 billion? Well, AIG was issuing credit default swaps. At least that's the bulk of the story. They were issuing credit default swaps, a form of bond insurance that banks like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and some foreign banks, Societe Generale, some German banks or other banks from around the world that bought these credit default swaps. Well, what's supposed to happen is AIG couldn't cover their obligations. They had nowhere near the assets needed to pay off these credit default swaps. They would have been bankrupt. Instead, the federal government stepped in and said, we're going to meet AIG's obligations. Okay, well, let's just be really clear on this. The federal government had zero obligation to honor AIG's debts. These are not insured deposits. It's not like if one of us had $2,000 in the bank and an FDIC insured deposit. AIG was an insurance company. Goldman Sachs and the others are supposed to be big boys and girls. They're supposed to understand who they're doing business with, supposed to be able to assess their creditworthiness. They apparently made a bad mistake. They invested with someone who wasn't creditworthy. Capitalist economy, you're supposed to be out your money. Not what happened. Government stepped in, Timothy Geithner stepped in, Ben Bernanke, Paul Paulson, Henry Paulson stepped in. They gave the money to Goldman Sachs, the other banks. They had no obligation to do it. There's no legal obligation, no moral obligation on the part of the government to do it. And in fact, they even gave them more money than AIG was obligated to do. Because what they did, at least in several cases, and I'm dying to get an explanation of this, what they did in several cases was they paid off these credit default swaps as though the underlying bonds had actually defaulted. So the deal was they paid off credit default swaps. Let's assume the bond had actually defaulted. You have to pay off the credit default swap at, let's say, 100 cents on the dollar. Well, in most cases, the bonds hadn't defaulted. It's very hard to understand that, except as something you might do if you want to give Goldman Sachs $4 billion, which is how much they paid them, above what AIG would have owed them, which, again, was an obligation of AIG, not an obligation of the U.S. government. Well, I could go on about other details of the bailout, but what I would say is these bailouts are oriented towards giving Wall Street money. And the second point that I'd make in that is we have no reason to want to give Wall Street money. The argument that we hear in Washington is we have no choice. I don't know how many people have talked about, well, the economy would collapse if we didn't do this. And what my next question to all those people was, how do we know that? And we don't know that. What they usually point to was we let Lehman Brothers collapse, the big investment bank collapse back in September. They go, well, that was really bad news. The credit markets froze up, blah, blah, blah. That's all true. But there's two big differences. One is that we've instituted a lot of safeguards in the last 6 months, 7 months, which actually have been fairly effective. So there's good reason to think that if there were something like a Lehman Brothers collapse, the credit markets would be able to continue to function. For example, just to give you one example, the Federal Reserve Board is now buying commercial paper directly from non-financial companies. So that means if you have an otherwise healthy company and for whatever reason they can't sell their commercial paper to pay their bills, to make their paycheck every month, Federal Reserve Board just buying it directly. So we have that solved. We don't have to worry about the whole economy shutting down that way. They'll still be able to get their commercial paper sold. They'll have the money to meet their payroll. The other reason why it's likely to be different is we wouldn't be talking about an unstructured bankruptcy where we just told Lehman, go to the bankruptcy judge and see what the bankruptcy judge tells you. What I and most other economists would say, well, let them go bankrupt. We're advocating a structured bankruptcy like they're trying to do with General Motors. So there's no reason to think that you'd have the same sort of panic, the same sort of fear going through financial markets as what you had with Lehman Brothers. In other words, there's no reason, I can't guarantee it won't happen, but there's no reason to think that you're just going to see this meltdown of the economy where none of us could pay our bills, use our ATMs, no one would accept our checks. There's just no reason. This is a false fear. So it's not really the case that they're holding us ransom. If we don't give them hundreds of billions of dollars, the economy will stop. What is the case is that these guys control our politicians and they're able to get the money, they're able to get their story in the media. It's simply not true. Now, at the end of the day, what do we have to do to get the economy going? What we have to do is actually very simple. Simply, it's stupidly simple. What we have to do is spend money. It's not a secret. You know, the problem with the economy right now is we have to make up that lost demand. As I said, I gave the number 2.6 trillion. That's a ballpark number. It could be higher by a few hundred billion, it could be lower by a few hundred billion, but we basically have to spend lots of money. And this, to my mind, gives us an incredible opportunity because, in principle, we could spend this money on good things. Things we might want, things like healthcare, things like improving the environment. One of the things that I've thrown on the table that, because it's my idea, it's a good idea. But one of the things we could do, most of us know, we're way different from the rest of the industrialized world, that people here work longer, they can't count on having paid time off, they don't get paid parental leave, they don't get paid vacation, paid sick days, people have to make the choice, do they lose their job or take care of their kids sometimes. We could do that. This gives us an opportunity to do that. We could give employers a tax credit to give workers paid time off. We have the money to do that. And it's a bizarre situation where ordinarily we think of the economy as being a situation where we don't have enough of things. We don't have enough. We want to have more of this or that, more goods and services, and we have a problem with scarcity. We don't have that problem right now. We really need to spend money. And again, that sounds stupid to people, but it's true. The reason why we have over 21 million people who are either unemployed or underemployed isn't because we don't have enough resources, it's because we don't have enough demand in the economy. So what we really have to do is get our politicians in Washington to stop worrying about Wall Street, tell those guys that, you know, learn how to run a business next time, and get focused on actually stimulating the economy, and hopefully stimulating the economy in ways that are productive, that will make this a better society. And it really is an incredible opportunity. I mean, the potential here is enormous, and not to say we're going to be in a Great Depression, but it's a Great Depression-type situation. And we know we did a lot of very good reforms. We got Social Security, we got the 40-hour work week, we got the Wagner Act, we got an awful lot out of the Great Depression. We're in that sort of situation again, if there's a political force to bring it about. So we have incredible potential. There's very big downside risks, but if there's the political pressure there, we could end up in a lot better place than we were before we went into this crisis.
That was Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research speaking on April 17, 2009. To learn more about the Center for Economic and Policy Research, go online to www.ceper.net. That's ceper.net. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.